All right, so good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, Thursday, March 19th, and we're going to finish up census and probably move on to endocrine system today. And the three chapters that will be on the next test, at least I hope so, will be autonomic nervous system, census for sure, and hopefully all of endocrinology, and we'll get that done before spring break. All right, so I'll get the last study guide up for endocrine system online for you real soon. Maybe not tomorrow, but maybe tomorrow night. I don't know. We'll see. And, of course, I'll load the lectures up there as well for you. All right, does anybody have any questions over what we've been talking about so far? New? Okay. All right, so let's finish up. So let's see, we are somewhere, maybe around here someplace. All right. Right around in this region. Okay, so we were talking about vision. And vision has a number of structures. Some are associated with the perception of light directly, and some just assist in helping the eye do its job, and those are what we call accessory structures. And so name some accessory structures for me and see if we can relate some functions to them. Some aren't really very complicated. What's an accessory structure to vision? Like eyelashes, yeah, and eyelids, right? They protect your eye. Lacrimal gland secretes tears, which moisten and lubricate your eye. There are extrinsic eye muscles that allow you to turn your eyeball without turning your head to look in a little bit different locations. There is the iris. What's the job of the iris? It can constrict or dilate to adjust the amount of light that's entering the eye so that you can see things with the proper contrast. And you should know what the sympathetic nervous system does to the pupil and the parasympathetic nervous system. You should be familiar with the circular fibers and the radial fibers. And there's another muscle in that general location of the eye. What's another muscle? It's not skeletal. You can't control it. It gets controlled automatically. So it's a smooth muscle. What's another smooth muscle in that part of the eye? It's very close to the iris. So it's not the radial or circular fiber. Yeah, but it is a circular, and it is the ciliary body or ciliary muscle. Now what does that do? What does the ciliary muscle do? What's the job? Now, oh, you guys are making me wonder if I even talked about this last time. But I think I did. Yeah, control. What about the lens does it control? It controls the thickness of the lens, and when the lens gets thick, the important thing to realize is that the curvature of the lens increases when it gets thick. And the ciliary muscle, depending on whether it's contracted or relaxed, can pull on the lens, and when it pulls on the lens, guess what? It gets thinner. So the focusing power is less, it diminishes. And so what do we call that property of the eye to be able to change the shape of the lens? And what does that mean to you in everyday life? That is? That's accommodation. And what does accommodation allow you to do? Allows you to go 95 miles an hour on the 405, right? Because you can look at your speedometer and look up out down the window, right? You can adjust for different distances of your vision, right? So that's called accommodation. So that you can read, and then if you look up from the piece of paper at the back of the room, you can see things in the back of the room. The lens has to change shape, right? So that's what we call accommodation. Now, the hard thing to know about all this, I'm not really impressed this morning that you guys are awake yet, but anyway, I'll give it one more try. All right, here's the difficult thing about the ciliary muscle. When it is contracted, is that when tension is applied to the suspensory ligaments, or is that when the tension is released from the suspensory ligaments? Okay. Yeah, when the ciliary body or muscle is contracted, that's when the tension is released, and that's when the lens gets really thick, and that's when you can focus up close. Well, you guys did good on the hard part, hard question. And when the ciliary muscle relaxes, that's when the suspensory ligaments actually pull on the lens and the lens flattens out for looking at things at a distance. All right, so now what is the part of the eye that actually can transduce light? And what does it transduce light into? What part of the eye can transduce light? It is the, I'll speak up just a little bit louder. Okay, rods and cones, those are in the retina. All right, and what does it transduce light into? What's the language of your brain? What language does your brain speak? Action potentials, that's right. Just a series of blips, 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 and as a result of that, you can see light intensity, different colors, and then your brain can figure out shapes and language and all kinds of amazing things, written language. So what part of your brain does all those action potentials go to? Yeah, you're like pointing to it, but you're not telling me with a lot of authority. It is what? The occipital lobe. That's right, it's the occipital lobe. All right, so we're going to talk about how those action potentials are produced because it's a pretty atypical kind of system compared to what you're familiar with so far. And last time we did talk about rod and cone cells. And I think in lab you went over the structure of the eye as well. So the rod cells are bigger, the cone cells are smaller. What can you and they have different jobs. Tell me something about the job of the rod cell. What does it do? What does it do good for us? Black and white. Yeah, it gives us black and white. So I don't know if that's such a good job. That's like, okay, that would you like to just see in black and white? Yeah, maybe not. What would you like to see with? Color. So the cones give us color vision, and they're small so that we can see high resolution. The rods right here are large, so we can't see fine detail with rods. We can't see color. So what is the good thing about a rod cell? It is very sensitive to light. So even in dim light conditions, we can still see. We just can't see in color, and we can't see in fine detail, but at least we won't like fall into a manhole with the cover missing because we can see that there's a hole in the sidewalk right there. Okay. And where do we have these cells in the retina? They're arranged in the retina by location. And this, I think, is just a review from anatomy as well. Okay. Well, where are the cone cells located? Where in the retina are they located? Like when you really want to, wait to think of this, if you really want to study an object, where do you place that in your visual field? Do you place that object right smack in the center, or do you put it way off in the periphery to take a close look at it? Right smack in the center, that's right. So your central vision, right, is predominated, or the central part of the retina is populated with cone cells, and as you move away, and what's that center part of your retina called? That's called the fovea centralis, okay, and that's pretty much 100% cone cells. Right, and the macula lutea is around it as well. That gives you your best vision, the highest resolution color image. And as you move to the periphery, then the cone cells give way to rod cells, and then by the time you're in your peripheral vision, it's pretty much 100% rod cells. So that's the sensitive area. So if you're trying to find an object someplace that's very dim, maybe with a dark background, and you look right at it and you can't see it, you might be able to see it if you use a different part of the retina, right? Because the rods are in your peripheral vision. So if you're trying to find a star at night, for instance, and it's dark enough to see a star and you look right at it, it disappears. But if you look off to the side, then that star light will be shining on some rod cells and it will pop into your visual field, as long as you don't look right at it. So maybe over the weekend, try that sometime with a very dim light. Look right at it, you'll see it disappear, look off to the side and it will be there. But, of course, it won't be so impressive because it won't have any color and it will look kind of blurry because you don't have the same kind of detail when you look at it. All right, so that's something about rod and cone cells. All right, they're deep in the retina. Right, so these are the photoreceptor cells, and then these are all the neurons that are associated with vision. And you can see there's a whole bunch of different kinds of neurons, including these bipolar cells right here. So this arrangement just adds to signal processing, which we don't really cover in this class. So there's a lot of signal processing that takes place in the retina before it even gets to the brain. as a result of these horizontal cells and amacrine cells. These ganglion cells, right, are the cell bodies of fibers that actually go to the brain. All right, so did we talk about this one? Yeah, I think we talked about this one. Okay, so rhodopsin, so we're going to confine our comments pretty much to the rod cells. The pigment in a rod cell is rhodopsin. And again, tell me, what is a pigment? What's a pigment? Yeah, it's a chemical that can absorb light. And if that chemical absorbs the full visual spectrum of light, what is that pigment going to look like? What color is that pigment going to look like? If it absorbs red, orange, yellow, blue, green, indigo, and violet, what color is that pigment going to look like to you? Okay, what is that pigment going to look like to you? If it absorbs all the colors of the rainbow, it's not going to look like any kind of color, right? It's going to look very, very dark, right? It's going to look black. So if there's a pigment that absorbs everything but red, what color is that going to look like? Like, is that the color of your sweatshirt right there? Close, okay. Okay, then it's going to look red. So we have different kinds of pigments in our retina. And rhodopsin pretty much is a broad spectrum absorber of electromagnetic radiation. So here is the retinol molecule. And it acts like pretty much an antenna that you have on your TV or radio. But in this case, it doesn't absorb radio waves. It absorbs light rays instead, light waves. And when it does, it changes shape. Because, why is that? Because light is really, what is light? Light is energy, right? And the different colors of a rainbow just signify the different amounts of energy that are in light. And when something absorbs energy, then energy is what? The ability to do work. It changes the conformation of retinol. It straightens out retinol so that it doesn't fit in the opsin molecule anymore. And that's what we call a bleaching reaction. And that takes time to restore rhodopsin back to its original condition. So sometimes when your retina is bleached, you can't see as well in the dark, right? Then you would have, you've been blinded by light. You can't see things as well in the dark. All right, so the ganglion cells actually produce action potentials that go to the brain. The rods and cones and these bipolar and horizontal cells just produce graded potentials. All right, so don't forget, action potentials are all or none kind of response. Graded potentials can summate, and they can interact with each other. Action potentials really don't. The visual transduction system is the inverse of other sensory systems that we're familiar with. So usually when a stimulus is applied to a receptor, what does it do to that receptor? What's it doing to a receptor? You have to think electrically now. Okay, how would you characterize some kind of stimulation, even to a nerve cell? How would you think about that? Stimulation is depolarization. How would you describe depolarization? Yeah, the movement of sodium inside the cell might cause an EPSP or something, and of course that's the first part of an action potential as well, depolarization. So usually we think of stimulation as depolarization, all right? And that is the result of some kind of stimulus that's being applied. Well, in the eye, what is the stimulus to the retina? Light, all right? And under those circumstances, all right, the rod cells and cone cells don't depolarize. So it's different. It's the exact opposite. In the absence of stimulus, that's when the rod cells and cone cells depolarize. All right, so but you can rely on your classical understanding of what depolarization means. And what does that mean? In the dark, I'm sorry? When they depolarize, that means sodium is entering. Okay, but I was wrong. That's not in the dark. That's in the light. Well, I'm going to have to show you. Light inhibits photoreceptor cells from releasing an inhibitory neurotransmitter. And when that happens, that stimulates the bipolar cells. So the rods and cones contain many sodium channels that are open in the dark. All right, so what does that mean? That means in the absence of stimuli, all right, that's when sodium enters the rod and cone cells and causes depolarization. That causes what, basically graded potentials or some kind of stimulatory influence. And that's when action potentials are not going to your brain, and that's when the rod and cone cells are depolarizing. So that's definitely an opposite condition compared to what we're used to. All right, so this depolarizing sodium influx is what we call the dark current, because that happens when the rods and cones don't have a stimulus. And when don't they have a stimulus? That's in the dark. So rods and cells depolarize in the dark because there are sodium channels that open up when it's dark, and so we call that the dark current when sodium can enter the cell. Light, on the other hand, which is what? That's the stimulus to the rod and cone cells. That hyperpolarizes the rods and cones by closing these sodium channels. So when there's a stimulus, that's when the rods and cones hyperpolarize, or that's when they are inhibited. So can you see that this is the reverse of most systems in your body? All right, so how does that happen? Here we have a disc, all right, in the outer segment of a rod cell, and there's rhodopsin incorporated into this disc. So here is the retinol part of rhodopsin, and associated with this disc are your familiar G proteins. All right, and in the dark, this sodium channel is open, and it's open because there is cyclic GMP that's being produced inside the cell, and cyclic GMP comes from what, guanosine triphosphate by guanylate cyclase, produces cyclic GMP. It binds to this receptor and opens up the receptor. Sodium enters the cell, and what does that do to the cell? That depolarizes the cell, right? All right, so that's in the dark. So this cell is being excited in the absence of stimulus in the dark. All right, there's also a molecule that's inactive, that's a phosphodiesterase in the dark condition right here. And the job of phosphodiesterase is to break cyclic GMP down into just regular old guanosine monophosphate. It just breaks the cyclic nature of this compound, changes it from a ring to a linear molecule, and when it does, it can't bind right here. All right, so in the light, what happens? Light comes in, the retinol absorbs that light, changes conformation, right? It becomes bleached, and when it does, it activates the G protein, and the alpha unit of the G protein attaches to the phosphodiesterase, and guess what it does to the phosphodiesterase? It activates it. Right, and then the job of phosphodiesterase is to convert cyclic GMP into just regular old GMP, and GMP by itself can't bind to the binding site on this sodium channel. So when it's released from the sodium channel, that closes the sodium channel. Now what happens to the cell when the sodium channel closes? It hyperpolarizes, right? That sodium current goes away, and don't forget that sodium current is what we call the dark current, that's in the absence of stimulus. So in the presence of the stimulus, this cell actually hyperpolarizes. Now let's see how the rest of the system can work properly. So this right here is an exam figure. So here we have two conditions, and here is kind of a nice illustration of how a whole little segment, a column of the retina works, starting with a rod cell, followed with a bipolar cell, and then a ganglion cell, which is going to send axons to the to your brain for the appreciation of light. So in the dark, what can you tell me about this rod cell in the dark? What's happening to the rod cell in the absence of stimulus? It is? Yeah, it's depolarizing. It's actually being stimulated in the absence of stimulus because of this channel right here, the sodium channel that is open, because it's binding. What is it binding in order to keep it open? There's plenty of cyclic GMP inside the cell that's keeping the sodium channel open. And that depolarizes. That depolarization causes release of neurotransmitter from the photoreceptor cell, which is going to affect this bipolar, but this neurotransmitter is inhibitory. So in the dark, inhibitory neurotransmitter is continuously being released, which then, right, inhibits the bipolar cell. And if the bipolar cell is inhibited, The ganglion cell is not receiving any neurotransmitter, so it is not depolarizing. So there are no action potentials being developed at the trigger zone right here. So after you look at this in a detail a little bit, it makes more sense. Right? So the ganglion cells are inhibited in the dark as a result of the dark current coming into the rod cell right here. And the reason why it works is because the rod cell releases which kind of neurotransmitter, an inhibitory or an excitatory? An inhibitory neurotransmitter, which inhibits the bipolar cell. Okay, now in the light condition, the phosphodiesterase, is it on this slide? It's not on this slide. The phosphodiesterase becomes activated because the G protein becomes activated and it breaks down cyclic GMP. Cyclic GMP goes away, so what happens to that sodium channel? It closes. The dark current goes away or it stops, so now this cell hyperpolarizes, and when we hyperpolarize a cell, what happens to neurotransmitter release? It stops. All right, so now the bipolar cell isn't inhibited, and it then automatically depolarizes and releases excitatory neurotransmitter on the ganglion cell. This excitatory neurotransmitter then causes action potentials that go to the brain. All right, so this is really a different kind of system, but I think it's important to know that these systems can be run in the reverse, and you just have to be familiar with what depolarization means and hyperpolarization in terms of release of neurotransmitter. And of course, you should be familiar that there can be different kinds of neurotransmitter. There are excitatory and inhibitory neurotransmitters, right? And so here is a system that uses an inhibitory neurotransmitter in the absence of a stimulus, okay, which prevents action potentials from going to the brain. All right, so that's pretty interesting. So make sure you can label all of this stuff right here. All right, now look at that and maybe ask me a question. I don't think I asked you to look at this figure on Tuesday, but look at that figure. Try labeling a number of times for lecture next week. All right, so if it's really confusing, you might not be able to remember what's going on there. So start drawing it out. That will improve your appreciation for what's going on, and then that will help your drawing, and that will help your understanding. Go back and forth a number of times until you have that understanding, then you can draw it out really great. Now, on those diagrams, on the exam figures, I talked to a couple students, and they said, well, it's really helpful to be able to label the blank diagrams that I have in the study guides. And indeed, that's true. You know, if you practice labeling them, I don't know, how many people have to label them 10 times to get them down? 10 times, okay. Yeah, that might be it, right? The first time takes a while, the second time maybe half the time, but by the 10th time, you could probably label it pretty fast, you know, maybe in a minute or something like that. So work so you can label it really fast, accurately. Something else that might help is somewhere along in that process, just start with a completely blank piece of paper with nothing on it and actually draw the figure, all right? So if you can actually draw the figure and then label it, then guess how taking the test is going to be? That's going to be really easy, right? So I'm not going to ask you to draw the figure on the test, right? Just label it. But if you can draw that figure, then you'll be able to label a figure on the test in just a couple minutes, right? So you might want to try that just to exercise, you know, different brain cells. That might help, right? Just to change your perspective in your mind on how that works. All right, so this looks kind of complicated, but there's only, how many cells in one column here? There's only three cells, so it's not that bad, okay? All right, so that's it for the senses chapter. Unless I can think of something else to say. I don't think so. The only other thing is that I kind of misled you a little bit when we were talking about the inner ear. All right, and this is the bony labyrinth with the membranous labyrinth on the inside. And what are the three senses associated with this organ right here? Yeah, you got hearing. You got kinetic equilibrium and static equilibrium, all right? And one of the first slides was labeled vestibular apparatus, all right? And so I just want to clarify something. The vestibular apparatus actually pertains to the semicircular canals and the vestibule. So this right here is the vestibular apparatus. And this part over here is really the cochlea. So the cochlea really isn't considered part of the vestibular apparatus. So vestibular apparatus have to do with the sense of equilibrium. The cochlea pertains to the sense of hearing. Okay, so I wouldn't call the cochlea the vestibular apparatus, although they're all connected together. Okay, they're all part of that bony labyrinth that makes up those three senses. All right, so that's all I'm going to say about senses. Okay? All right, so moving on to endocrinology. All right, so endocrinology chapter is kind of long. I don't think it's terribly difficult. I think you pretty much know all the basic physical chemistry or physical chemistry principles, how your body works. So now you're just going to layer some information on to things that you already know. So this is actually kind of the fun part of the class. But there are a lot of details in endocrinology. It's going to remind you probably more like anatomy class, where you have to put a lot of details together and maybe not a whole lot of understanding. So we'll see. Okay. So let's just talk first about endocrine glands in general. They're a special kind of gland. And there are two main kinds of glands in your body. So if you think of a gland, what are the two main classes that a gland could fall into? A gland could have a duct that carries a product someplace, maybe a long distance, or a gland might not have a duct. All right, so those are the two conditions. And what is a gland that has a duct called? That's an exocrine gland. A gland that does not have a duct is a endocrine gland. So exocrine and endocrine. Give me an example of an exocrine gland. Exocrine. I hear a lot of I must be losing my hearing today. How about a sweat gland or a salivary gland, for instance? Okay, those products are carried through a duct, and if it's a sweat gland, it's released to the surface of your skin, and if it's a salivary gland, saliva gets released to the inside of your mouth, right, for instance. And there's another kind of gland that doesn't really fit into either of those categories. Mostly it's kind of considered an exocrine gland, but it's just a single cell. What's a unicellular gland? What's the name of a unicellular gland? And it certainly doesn't secrete anything into the blood, but it doesn't secrete anything into a duct either. It secretes something onto the surface of an epithelium. A goblet cell, right? A goblet cell just secretes mucus. And that's sort of neither an exocrine or an endocrine gland. Okay. So endocrine glands are ductless glands that secrete hormones into the bloodstream. So what the heck is a hormone? It's some kind of molecule. It's a signaling molecule that gets synthesized by an endocrine gland, and it gets picked up by a capillary, and it's delivered. Where is it delivered once it's in your circulatory system? Once it's in your circulatory system? You said everywhere. Exactly right. It goes everywhere in your body, right? It gets distributed everywhere. All right, and it may or may not have an effect on a tissue. In order for it to have an effect on a tissue, that tissue has to have a special protein in the membrane. What's that special membrane protein called? That's a receptor, right? So there has to be a binding site. There has to be an active site for that hormone. How would you explain binding of a hormone to a receptor? What's a good model in your mind that maybe you should have? Lock and key, based on the shape, right? The shape of the active site on that receptor has to be complementary to the shape of the signaling molecule in order for it to bind. And then when it binds, it's going to cause a response in that cell. So in order for a tissue to be a target tissue, it has to have a receptor, or else it's going to be completely unaware that that hormone or signaling molecule is in the circulatory system. All right, so that's the whole thing about the endocrine system. Okay, so a hormone. What's a hormone? It's secreted by an endocrine gland. It's picked up by the circulatory system, distributed all over the body, where it binds to a receptor on a target tissue. And when it does, it produces a specific response inside that cell. So that's what a hormone is. Okay, but then we ran into some other things. All right, there are signaling molecules that behave that way, but they're not necessarily secreted by an endocrine gland. They're secreted by a neuron. And what did we call those things that act like hormones, but they're not secreted by an endocrine gland? They're secreted by a neuron. That's what we call a neurohormone, right? So we would have to change our definition a little bit. We maybe would have to say that neuron really is an endocrine gland, but that would be too radical. It's better to just say, well, that signaling molecule is a neurohormone. That's the best thing to say. Okay, so hormones affect metabolism in target tissues. And how can a hormone affect metabolism in a target tissue? How can a target tissue see that there is a hormone there trying to signal it to do something? What does a target tissue have to have? It's got to have a receptor, right? Got to have a receptor. Okay, so here are a bunch of endocrine glands in our body. For instance, the hypothalamus is pretty much the master endocrine gland in our body. It controls the pituitary, and then the pituitary controls numerous other endocrine glands in the body. And don't forget, what kind of tissue is in the hypothalamus? Those are all neurons up there, nervous tissue. Okay, pituitary gland, so we got some other glands like the thyroid gland. We have adrenal glands that we talked about. The pancreas is pretty important, so I'm going to come back to the pancreas. Ovaries, right, and testes for reproduction are important endocrine glands for controlling various things in our body. And the pancreas right here has both kinds of glands. It has exocrine glands as well as endocrine glands. As far as the exocrine part, what does the pancreas produce from the exocrine division of the pancreas? The pancreas makes digestive enzymes, right? And those digestive enzymes have to go from the pancreas via a tube to the small intestine, where they become activated. So that's the exocrine part of the pancreas. The endocrine part of the pancreas is the result of cells that are in little islands within the pancreas. So we call these the islets of Langerhans sometimes. And they secrete a couple of hormones called insulin and another one called glucagon, which we're going to talk about a little bit later. Okay, so some organs are pretty complex. They have both endocrine as well as exocrine functions. All right, so here is a list, which I'm not going to go over right now, that describes the various hormones. You'll be familiar with, after studying this chapter, most of these hormones right here. So their names, the gland that secretes them, what the target tissue is, and then the primary effect of these hormones. So I want to cover some of these things, but I just don't want to read this table to you. All right, so we can classify hormones by what they're made out of. There are some amine hormones that are derived from tyrosine and tryptophan. You're familiar with some of these already, like norepinephrine and epinephrine. What gland secretes norepinephrine and epinephrine? That's going to be on the test. The kidney. That's close, but not quite. It's what? It's the adrenal gland is right above the kidney. I figured you're probably pulling my leg. Okay, so these are, right, these would be good examples of neurohormones, right, from the adrenal medulla. Thyroxine, where does thyroxine come from? That's the thyroid gland, for instance. Okay. Melatonin, I don't make a big deal of in this class, but that comes from the pineal gland. Yeah.
The adrenal gland, it's still considered a gland, even though, isn't it like technically neurohormone?
Yes, technically. In that case, the cells that release norepinephrine and epinephrine act really more like an endocrine gland than a neuron. And the reason why that is because they don't transmit electrical impulses. Right? When they're stimulated by a preganglionic sympathetic fiber, they don't send an electrical impulse long way to a target organ someplace. They just release norepinephrine and epinephrine. So those modified postganglionic cells of the adrenal medulla really act in that particular case more like an endocrine gland than a neuron. Yeah. All right, so you can see some of the complications of just using nomenclature. All right, so you have to keep an open mind and be flexible. There are other kinds of hormones that are proteins or polypeptides. These are just what? Chains of amino acids. These include things like insulin and glucagon that we're going to talk about. Oxytocin we'll talk about. Antidiuretic hormone. Oh, I think you were tested on antidiuretic hormone, maybe on the first test. Guess what it does? Antidiuretic hormone. Antidiuretic. What would a diuretic do? Diuretic would make you pee. An antidiuretic would keep you from peeing, would retain fluid, body fluid. All right. GH stands for growth hormone, adrenal corticotropic hormone, and parathyroid hormone. These are some hormones that are proteins. There are glycoprotein type hormones. When we say glycoprotein, what does that mean? Glycoprotein is a mixture of part protein and part carbohydrate, right? So they've been modified, for instance, by the Golgi apparatus that combines a protein with a sugar molecule. Here are some important hormones that are of that nature, LH, FSH, and TSH. LH and FSH are involved with your reproductive system, and TSH is involved with regulating your thyroid gland. Then there are steroid hormones. These are what? Lipids. And all of these are derived from cholesterol. So all of these hormones, including testosterone, estrogen, progesterone, cortisol, need cholesterol as their base building block molecule. So if you have too much cholesterol, of course that's bad because it produces cardiovascular disease. But you can't be depleted or devoid of cholesterol because why? You wouldn't be able to make any of these important hormones right here. And I probably don't know anybody that would like to be completely devoid of estrogen or testosterone, right? So you need some cholesterol in your body. All right, so you recognize this molecule right here, right? What is that? That's just cholesterol, and it can be converted into these various kinds of compounds, right, in the adrenal gland, for instance, and in the testes and in the ovaries. So all of these compounds are related to each other. All right, so here's testosterone. Androstenedione, that is an analog to testosterone. So it has male sex hormone capabilities. Here is estradiol. Estradiol is produced from testosterone, and this is what, a female sex hormone right here. So you should be able to tell that all these molecules are related to each other. And why is it that these molecules, even though, I mean, they almost look the same, okay? There's only a difference of one hydrogen atom right here. How is it that they can have drastically different influences in somebody's body? Right? So you could consider these molecules almost the same, but why do they have much different kinds of actions in different people? Because of the receptors, right, in different people, depending, for instance, on their gender. That's right. Okay. All right, so here's the chemical formula for a thyroid hormone, and thyroid hormone is called, you can see that it is modified by adding iodine atoms to it. And tetraiodothreonine has 4 iodines, triiodothreonine has only 3 iodines on it. And the active form is what we call T3, or triiodothreonine. And this molecule is not soluble in water like the steroid molecules. All right, so the steroid and thyroid hormones are lipids. They can diffuse into target cells in order to elicit a response. And before it can elicit a response, what do all of these steroid or thyroid hormones, what do they have to do before they can elicit a response? They have to bind to a receptor. Now, where are the receptors located at? Are they going to be on the surface of the cell or inside the cell? Okay. Usually, okay, for hormones, they're on the surface of the cell, but for these classes of hormones, because they're lipids, and since they can enter the cell, the receptors are in their cytoplasmic receptors, or maybe they're even nuclear receptors. All right, so receptors for steroid and thyroid hormones are inside the cell because they're not stopped by the plasma membrane. And you could probably hopefully explain to me why the plasma membrane doesn't stop them, like hydrophilic kinds of signaling molecules. Okay, so let's compare and contrast the nervous system with the endocrine system just to get a feel for what's going on. Both the nervous system and endocrine system use chemicals to communicate. Sometimes we call those signaling molecules. Sometimes we call them ligands. All right, the difference between neurotransmitters and hormones is transport in blood, okay, and more diversity of effects in hormone targets. Right, so hormones are transported in the blood. Neurotransmitters just diffuse across the synaptic cleft. And some chemicals, under certain circumstances, can be used as hormones as well as neurotransmitters. Good example would be what? Norepinephrine is a good example of that. Targets for both neurotransmitters and hormones must have specific receptors, and it has to obey the lock and key model for activating those receptors. And both must have a way to be rapidly inactivated so that when you secrete a hormone, its effects don't last your whole life, because then that signaling molecule won't be useful to signal another event or a change someplace. Typically, neurotransmitters are inactivated very rapidly because of reuptake or because of degradatory enzymes that are in the synaptic cleft, but the blood itself doesn't contain any inactivating enzymes that inactivate, say, norepinephrine when it's released from the adrenal medulla. So once the adrenal medulla gets activated to release norepinephrine, you'll feel the effects of that hormone for a relatively long period of time. Okay, compared to if it's acting just within a synapse. Okay, so tissues, or one tissue might respond to a number of different hormones. A tissue can regulate its activity in a number of different ways. And if two hormones work together to produce some effect, we call them synergistic. Right? So just like skeletal muscle. And as a matter of fact, if they're synergistic, it might produce an effect that's larger than if we were just to add together the two individual effects. All right? So if hormone number one or hormone number A produces an effect of number one, a magnitude of one, and hormone B produces an effect, say, a magnitude of number one. All right, so if we add those two effects together, the effect would be two. But if things are really working synergistically together, if we have both hormones A and B, the effect isn't going to be two. It might be five or ten or something much higher in magnitude than if we were just to add the two effects individually. All right, so a hormone could have a permissive effect if it enhances the responsiveness of a target tissue or target organ to a second hormone. And as a matter of fact, the second hormone might not even have any effect unless that first hormone is there and participates in the reaction, maybe binding to another site on the receptor someplace to activate the receptor. All right, if the action of one hormone inhibits the effect of another, it is antagonistic. Now, is that a good thing or a really bad thing? That's good, okay? And why is that good? Because it's important for balance and precise control. Balance and precise control. And you could probably give me the names of a couple hormones that are antagonistic to you, and you have both of those hormones in your body, I hope. So don't think about like testosterone and estrogen, because that's maybe not a good example in one individual. But in one individual, there are hormones that are set up based on these antagonistic principles, and insulin and glucagon in terms of the easy one to consider is just blood glucose levels, right? Okay, coming from the pancreas are antagonistic. Okay, let's talk about some mechanisms of hormone action. Target cell receptors show specificity, right? And that means what? That means that the active site of a receptor has to be complementary to the shape of the molecule. So only certain shapes can bind to the receptor. It has high affinity, so if the shapes match up properly, then very low levels of hormones can have a pretty important impact on the metabolism of the target tissue. And low capacity just means that that a cell does not have a lot of receptors. So a particular tissue won't absorb a lot of hormone out of the circulatory system. There'll still be plenty of signaling molecule left over. So you could think of going back to maybe enzymes and think about all the characteristics of enzymes are shared by receptors. Okay, lipophilic hormones have receptors in target cytoplasm because they can move across the plasma membrane. Or maybe the receptors are even inside the nucleus because it can diffuse through the plasma membrane. All right, the target is the nucleus if it's a lipophilic kind of signaling molecule. And all of these molecules, like the steroid hormones and the thyroid hormones, work by activating transcription. All right, so where does transcription take place? That's one of the things that you just had to memorize by rote, but you probably have a good understanding now. That happens in that's the first step of protein synthesis. Transcription happens in the nucleus. So steroid and thyroid hormones have a way to activate genes to turn on protein synthesis. Okay, so we call that the genomic action. And turning on protein synthesis to make a protein takes a relatively long time to do that, at least 30 minutes, in order to actually influence the production of proteins within a cell. Right, whereas receptors for water-soluble signaling molecules are on the surface of the target cell. And why is that? Because these hydrophilic molecules can't get through the plasma membrane. So if the receptors were inside the cell, they could never bind to those receptors to cause a response. All right, so since those signaling molecules are outside the cell, they don't work through ion channels necessarily. Right, they're going to change metabolism inside the cell. They're stuck outside, so these signaling molecules are first messengers. So what's a good way to transduce a signal from outside the cell, which is a first messenger? It gets converted into a second messenger inside the cell, which is going to regulate metabolism inside the cell. So water-soluble hormones act through second messengers. These effects are quick. Okay. There's a very few steroid hormones that act on cell surface receptors, and most steroid receptors work by genomic action because they initiate transcription, but these that bind to surface receptors act through a non-genomic action. So that's kind of atypical that a steroid hormone works through some kind of non-genomic action. Yeah.
So the water-soluble ones, are those considered non-genomic?
Those would be non-genomic as well. They're going to directly affect enzymes that are already produced inside the cytoplasm. I don't know of any that actually affect transcription. There are probably a number of good examples of that. Okay. So hormones that bind to nuclear, that are lipid soluble, okay, they bind to nuclear receptor proteins. All right, so where are those nuclear receptor proteins? They're inside the cell. They're not on the outside of the cell. They're in the cytoplasm someplace. So here we have a lipophilic hormone. Now, is this thing going to want to dissolve in blood, a lipophilic? No, it's probably going to want to precipitate out and float around as a blob of oil in your circulatory system, which would be pretty terrible because that would plug up a blood vessel someplace and cause a stroke or whatever, a thrombus. So steroid hormones and thyroid hormones are attached to carrier proteins that can dissolve in plasma, right? And so hormones are always in some equilibrium of dissolving partially in plasma and then attaching to the carrier protein. So where do you think you have most of the hormones? Free in the plasma or bound to carrier proteins? Yeah, bound to proteins. Only a very little bit will actually be able to dissolve in the plasma, a very minuscule amount. But nonetheless, those that are can diffuse down a concentration gradient into the cell. All right, and when it diffuses into the cell, then that redistributes this equilibrium. Right, so more hormone can dissociate from the carrier protein. Right, so what do we call that action? Like if hormone diffuses into the cell, and that's going to cause the dissociation of hormone from the carrier protein. We kind of look at that in terms of a chemical reaction. That was even on the last test. Oh, that was a hard question on the last test. Okay, that was called what? Le Chatelier's principle, right? So if we were to add a lot of carrier proteins that are not binding the hormone, then even more hormone that's dissolved in the blood would attach to it, right? So this can go back and forth either way, just to reestablish the equilibrium. So these are what we call nuclear hormone receptors. Now, I don't see it in the nucleus right here, right? It's just in the cytoplasm. But when it binds the hormone signaling molecule, guess where it goes? It goes into the nucleus, right? So it's going to have its effect inside the nucleus. It gets translocated into the nucleus, and it can bind to DNA. And as a result, when it binds to DNA, it can initiate transcription, which is what? The production of messenger RNA, and then that leaves the nucleus into the cytoplasm, and then the second step of protein synthesis takes place. What's the second step called?
Translation.
Yeah, translation, and that's going to produce some kind of response inside the cell, and that could be an enzyme or it could be a structural protein, so it can have very important effects inside the target cell. But in order for this target cell to be a target cell, what does it have to have? It's got to have the proper receptor so that the signaling molecule can bind to it. Okay, so nuclear hormone receptors serve as transcription factors, all right, when they bind a hormone, all right, and that activates transcription. So these nuclear hormone receptors constitute a superfamily composed of steroid family and thyroid hormone family, which includes vitamin D and retinoic acid. So these nuclear hormone receptors can bind, if it's the right one, can bind all of the different steroid hormones, T3, T4, and other molecules like vitamin D and retinoic acid. All right, so let's see how these actually work together. Okay, so a nuclear hormone receptor, like what we have right here, has got two domains. They have a DNA binding domain and a ligand binding domain. So the ligand binding domain binds the hormone signaling molecule, and then this unit becomes activated so that the DNA binding domain then can attach to a hormone response element, a part of DNA that's at the beginning of a gene that can be transcribed to make a protein. And you can see that this hormone response element right here has two parts to it. So we say that it has two half sites. And a half site can bind one nuclear hormone receptor once it's been activated. Right? So for instance, if this is going to bind a steroid hormone right over here, it can bind to a half site, but before it becomes a viable transcription factor, it has to bind a second hormone response element or a nuclear hormone receptor. So both half sites have to be occupied in order to turn on transcription for this particular gene right here. So we call that dimerization of the receptor, right? And in this particular case, because they're the same, they're identical, right? We would call that homodimerization. Homo just meaning the same, all right? When the hormone response unit just requires two identical hormone receptors. All right, well, that's not always the case. We already talked about this already. That's not always the case. Another case would be, for instance, for thyroid hormone. Let me make sure I go back. Okay. The thyroid secretes about 90% thyroxin, which is T4, and only 10% T3. 99, almost 100% in the blood is T4 when it's bound to the carrier protein. Right, and that carrier protein is called thyroid binding globulin, so that it just allows T4 to dissolve in the plasma. But only the free can enter cells. So the bound is a reservoir of T4. And once inside the cell, T4 is converted into T3 and iodine is clipped off, and that becomes the active compound that can bind to the receptor protein. And this one is located within the nucleus. Right? It's not a cytosolic receptor, it's a nuclear receptor. Okay, so T3 will bind to its nuclear receptor. The other half site binds another receptor over here. All right, so T3 binds to this receptor, and retinoic acid binds to a second kind of receptor. These both have to bind to the hormone response element before gene transcription takes place. All right, so this illustrates what the permissive effect of retinoic acid on transcription that is going to be signaled by triiodothreonine. Because triiodothreonine all by itself cannot initiate transcription, there also has to be what the receptor for retinoic acid as well. So some of these hormone response units require what, two kinds of signaling molecules, not just one, in order for transcription to take place. All right, and when the hormone response element binds this dimer right here, so this dimer right here is what we call a heterodimer because it requires two different kinds of signaling molecules. Okay. All right, well, let's talk about some water-soluble ones. So all of those that we've been looking at so far are lipid-soluble hormones. Water-soluble use cell surface receptors because, of course, they can't pass through the plasma membrane. And so that signal has to be transduced. A nice way of doing that is by using second messengers inside the cell. So the hormone is extracellular. We call that the first messenger. The second messenger then carries a signal from the receptor to inside the cell to produce some kind of response. And a really good example of a second messenger would be cyclic AMP. And how can you make cyclic AMP? When you take an ATP in the presence of an active adenylate cyclase. So adenylate cyclase converts ATP into cyclic AMP, so that's a relatively expensive process because it uses up ATP in the cell just to make a signaling molecule. All right, so here you have an adenylate cyclase, but it shouldn't be turned on all the time. It should only be turned on when there is a signaling molecule present. All right, so a good way of doing that typically is with a G-protein coupled receptor. So here is the G-protein. It gets activated when the receptor binds a particular signaling molecule. And then the alpha subunit comes over to adenylate cyclase, associates with it, changes conformation so that it becomes active, and that produces cyclic AMP inside the cell. So the first messenger is this hormone. The second messenger is cyclic AMP. And again, this is a cascade with various steps of amplification. So one signaling molecule can produce many, many cyclic AMPs inside the cell because this enzyme, namely what? Adenylate cyclase, doesn't get degraded when it undergoes the reaction, right? So it's just an enzyme. It's not changed by the reaction. The only thing that changes is what? ATP is converted into product, namely the second messenger, cyclic AMP. So there's a step of amplification. Did I see a question? New? Okay. So cyclic AMP then can bind to a complex which is made up of a protein kinase and an inhibitory subunit that's bound to a protein kinase. So what's the job of a protein kinase again? Protein kinase is going to phosphorylate something, right? It's going to run around and phosphorylate enzymes, for instance. And when it phosphorylates an enzyme, it's going to change the activity of that enzyme. It might turn it on or might turn it on. It acts like a switch to turn enzymes on and off. Well, this inhibitory subunit can bind cyclic AMP, and when it does, it dissociates from this inactive protein kinase. And when the inhibitory subunit binds to it, that protein kinase becomes activated. All right? And so then it can activate various proteins inside the cell, turning on or turning it off, metabolism or various kinds of pathways that are going to change the metabolism of the cell. And so this is what? Just another step of amplification because this protein kinase doesn't get degraded when it can activate or deactivate other kinds of enzymes. So this is a typical cascade mechanism that's useful for what? Amplification of just this one signaling molecule outside the cell. All right, so that's the adenylate cyclase. And adenylate cyclase is very soluble in the cytoplasm. Okay, I talked about that already. Why do I have all these slides? Let me see. Okay, the activity of cyclic AMP is always balanced by another enzyme that is active inside the cell. What kind of enzyme can break down a cyclic AMP or a cyclic GMP? That was from the sensory chapter. We just talked about that. All right, so now you know a couple important enzymes. What kind of enzyme adds a phosphate to something? That's a kinase. What kind of enzyme takes a phosphate off? That's a phosphatase. And what's the name of an enzyme that will break down a cyclic AMP or a cyclic GMP? That's called a phosphodiesterase. Phosphodiesterase. So that pretty much is always active inside the cell, and that's what maintains the balance, right? So that phosphodiesterase is in balance with what? Adenylate cyclase to produce just the right level of cyclic AMP inside the cell, which is determined by this binding of hormone to receptor. So that's an antagonistic system. So that should actually kind of be nice and reassuring to see. Okay, so that's a phosphodiesterase. Here's a second kind of transduction system. So the first transduction system uses what? G protein coupled receptors and adenylate cyclase to produce cyclic AMP as a second messenger. That's the first kind of transduction system. Here's another one. This uses phospholipase C and calcium. All right. So this is also a second messenger system for some hormones. So you have a hormone binding to, what does this look like? That's your typical G protein coupled receptor complex. And when hormone binds to it, it activates the G proteins, which dissociate, and it runs into a phospholipase C enzyme. So this is an enzyme because you see this ASC right here. And what does phospholipase, what does it work on? What's the molecule that phospholipase can metabolize? What's the substrate for phospholipase C? It's lipid. What kind of lipid? Phospholipid. Yeah, it needs a, so it can use phospholipid as a substrate, all right? And is that fortunate or unfortunate? Is there any phospholipid around in this membrane that it can actually use as a substrate? There's not any, right? Okay, but if you look, you see rows and rows of what? Phospholipids. Well, that's the basic building block of the plasma membrane. So it can actually use part of the structure of the cell converted into inositol 3-phosphate, I just call that IPI-3, right? So phospholipase 3 produces IPI-3, which then enters the cell, so this is going to be a second messenger. IPI-3 is a second messenger. And when it binds to smooth endoplasmic reticulum, and you can tell this is smooth endoplasmic reticulum pretty easily, one of the functions of smooth endoplasmic reticulum in some cells is to act as a reservoir for calcium ions. So remember, across the plasma membrane, what's the usual gradient for calcium? Where is calcium ion high, outside or inside the cell? It's high outside. So usually cytosolic calcium is very, very low because there are calcium pumps in the smooth endoplasmic reticulum. For instance, you're familiar, no, we haven't talked about this yet, skeletal muscle. Okay, so calcium is pumped in the smooth endoplasmic reticulum in many cells, but it can be released. It can go down its concentration gradient when it binds the second messenger, inositol 3-phosphate. And when calcium enters the cytosol, that can produce a number of different effects inside of a cell. It can activate metabolism. It can even cause muscles to contract, various kinds of activities. All right, so this is the phospholipase C. What was the first mechanism? What was the enzyme of the first mechanism called? That was? Yeah, the first one was adenylate cyclase making cyclic AMP. The second one that we're looking at is phospholipase C making inositol 3-phosphate, right? IPI-3. So IPI-3 right here is acting like what? Cyclic AMP, right? And even you could think of maybe even calcium, this calcium as being a second messenger inside the cell. All right, so here is one level of amplification. Here is a second level of amplification in this cascade mechanism, all due to the binding of this one simple hormone right here. All right, so that's the phospholipase C mechanism. Okay, another signaling molecule, along with IPI3, can be diacyl glyceride, and that is stuck inside the plasma membrane that can activate other kinds of channels. So I think I included this slide because it is interesting that we have actually two domains where things are actively changing, where metabolism is actively changing. One is what the water environment inside the cell, but there's a whole other world. Where is our whole other world where things are taking place? Inside, actually completely contained with inside the membrane. Here's a lipid world, and we're just beginning to understand this lipid world and what's happening inside there in terms of living processes. So I think that's going to be really fascinating to watch, right, over the next 10 or 20 years. And diacyl glycerol is one of these molecules that pretty much just lives within the membrane, okay, and ends up regulating metabolism inside the cell. All right, and that's produced by phospholipase C. And, of course, phospholipase C has to be inside the membrane because that's where the substrate is. All right, so calcium diffuses into the cytoplasm. And is it easy for calcium to dissolve in the cytosol or in the cytoplasm? Why can calcium dissolve in the cytoplasm easily? Because it's an ion, right? And ions dissolve in water very easily, right? Okay. And calcium activates calmodulin. And when calmodulin is activated, it can turn on protein kinases. And the job of these protein kinases is to phosphorylate enzymes, right, which then produce the effects that hormone signal is trying to elicit. All right, so most calcium second messenger systems rely on that calmodulin, and that is a molecule that's a cousin to another molecule that we're going to become familiar with, which causes muscle contraction. And calmodulin is related to a molecule called troponin. So when I mention troponin when we start studying muscles, maybe you can relate it to calmodulin a little bit because calmodulin binds calcium. All right, so here is a hormone, epinephrine. Where does epinephrine come from? Yeah, the adrenal medulla, right? So it's a hormone. And so let's look specifically at one important mechanism of epinephrine. And the important mechanism is going to be its effect on blood glucose levels. All right, so over here we're going to look at blood glucose levels. So what kind of organ can make glucose and secrete it into the blood when glucose is low? Yeah, the liver is the only one. Right, and you learned it because it's the only tissue that has glucose 6-phosphatase that can take phosphate off of a glucose, and then that glucose ends up in the blood. All right, so what is the storage form of glucose in the liver? It is glycogen, right? And when you break glycogen down, what do we call that process again? That is, you thought you could forget it. No, you can't forget it just yet. It's still a tongue twister. It's what? Glycogenolysis, right? When you break glycogen down. So there should be something that is controlling glycogenolysis so that your blood glucose doesn't skyrocket, right? So that would be bad if it lost control. All right, so the levels of glucose can be raised in the blood is due to sympathetic activity, right? Sympathetic nervous system goes down to the adrenal medulla, stimulates the release of norepinephrine and epinephrine, and epinephrine can bind to a beta receptor on the liver, and the liver also has alpha receptors, right? And these are what, cholinergic or adrenergic receptors? These are adrenergic receptors because they're binding norepinephrine, or epinephrine in this particular case, epinephrine. And we see that there are two different mechanisms where glycogenolysis can be activated. One is due to a beta adrenergic receptor. And the beta adrenergic, I think you learned for the last test, works through a G protein coupled receptor, which produces cyclic AMP, right? The betas produce cyclic AMP. And, well, it says right there. So what's the enzyme that has to be activated? That's adenylate cyclase, produces cyclic AMP. That activates a protein kinase. Right, this protein kinase will snip off glucoses, and when it does it, it has to phosphorylate that glucose molecule. Right, so it phosphorylates glucose, makes glucose 1-phosphate, and then there's another enzyme that is an isomerase that converts it into glucose 6-phosphate, and then of course in the liver there is what, glucose 6-phosphatase, which turns it into free glucose, and that ends up in the blood. All right, but what's the other kind of receptor besides the beta? You have alpha receptors in the liver. Alpha receptors work through calcium as a second messenger system. All right, so not cyclic AMP, but calcium. So now calcium levels inside the cell that increase binds to calmodulin. Calmodulin can activate protein kinases, which then stimulate glycogenolysis. Right, and then going through the same metabolic pathway right here that increases free glucose in the cell, the liver cell, which then secretes free glucose into the blood. So here is a mechanism by which epinephrine can work with beta adrenergic receptors and alpha adrenergic receptors to do what? Regulate blood glucose levels. And these are going to be due to what kind of activity? An increase in what kind of tone? Sympathetic tone or parasympathetic tone? Sympathetic tone. Now, does this make sense in terms of how we think of the sympathetic nervous system and the parasympathetic nervous system? What's the sympathetic nervous system supposed to do for us? What is that? It's the fight or flight mechanism, right? So when you're going to be using muscles a lot, guess what they need? What do they need? What do the mitochondria need to make a lot of ATP in muscles? What do mitochondria need to make ATP? They need glucose to do that, right? So this supports the fight or flight response, not the rest and digest response. Right? So if you're thinking about the sympathetic nervous system, you know, always kind of think about it in terms of those two general kinds of responses. Okay, I don't think I have this as an exam figure, but I actually have to look and see. Okay, the tyrosine kinase. Second messenger system. All right, so tyrosine kinase, what can you tell me about tyrosine kinase? You know a lot about it. What does a kinase do? It's going to phosphorylate something. Guess what it's going to phosphorylate? A tyrosine amino acid that's on a protein someplace. And what's that going to do? That's going to change the activity of that protein somehow or another. And maybe we don't understand this mechanism in its entirety yet, but this is real important because a tyrosine kinase second messenger system is important for insulin. And have you ever heard of insulin before? Absolutely, right? And so let's look at this receptor because remember there are two major kinds of diabetes. There's diabetes type 1, diabetes type 2, right? And diabetes type 1 is what kind of diabetes? It all has to do with blood glucose regulation. It means that your body is not producing insulin, right? What about diabetes type 2? Yeah, that means your blood insulin could be at the proper level. The pancreas is working just fine, but you still can't regulate blood glucose because the receptor isn't working. That might be just one of the reasons. Maybe the receptor isn't being built properly, but for some reason, it's no longer controlling metabolism inside the cell. And so this is really fascinating because we're beginning to understand something about that receptor. And if we know more about that insulin receptor, that's really good because we'll be able to treat or help somebody with diabetes type 2. So that's very important. So how many subunits does the insulin receptor have? It looks like two, right? So there are two subunits right here. When there is an insulin signal, these two subunits can come together, right? So we call that step dimerization. And after they dimerize, there are ATPases on this receptor, and they become phosphorylated, okay? And when they become phosphorylated, then there is another ATPase that becomes activated, which can phosphorylate other molecules inside the cell. All right, so other molecules come by, and if there's a tyrosine in just the right position on this molecule inside the cell, it becomes phosphorylated. Then what happens to the shape of this molecule right here? It changes, right? It's going to change shape, which means it's going to change activity. And that's going to have a cascade of effects inside the cell, and that's going to cause glucose uptake and also regulate anabolic reactions inside the cell. All right, so when we start next time, I want to start probably with this slide right here because it probably looks a little foreign to you, but you got to become familiar with it. Plus, you got to be able to relate it to this figure right here. And this is actually a really easy figure to understand because we're going to be talking about these endosomes. And just try to refresh your memory what a GLUT4 transporter is. What a GLUT4 transporter is. Okay, so have a nice weekend.